Diamond Dogs by Bowie. Available on RCA Records and Tapes worldwide. Diamond Dogs by Bowie. A Main Man production.
Hello again, everyone, mums and dads and boys and girls, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed, and the second part of my conversation with Stuart McConey about 1974's Diamond Dogs. Thank you to everyone who's been in touch about the first part of the podcast. It seems that loads of you have been revisiting the album in the last few weeks, as have I, and it's been keeping me company around here the last few days, and I'm really enjoying rediscovering Diamond Dogs, especially side two, which I never really got into before, but it is fantastic. And we're going to talk more about side two in the next edition of the episode, because we haven't actually recorded it yet. Stuart and I only had a certain amount of time, and in the previous edition we got to about an hour, and then in this edition we've got that half hour after that. In that time we only really get to Rebel, but it's the scenic route to Rebel, so we're going to try and get together on Skype and do the next conversation soon. In the meantime, enjoy this installment and keep safe, and I look forward to being back soon with much more. Thank you and enjoy. He made a film while he was recording it. He was recording a lot of stuff on Super 8.
Okay.
Bowie claims that some of the footage features an impatient John Lennon in the background berating him with the words, "What the bloody hell are you doing, Bowie, with all this mutant crap?" As Bowie tinkers with a clay model of Hunger City, the album's post-apocalyptic.
That's
What are you doing, Bowie?
Can imagine Lennon saying that, can't you? Because for all of his, again, for all his pretentiousness later on in his life, he was essentially, he was a Chuck Berry fan, John Lennon, wasn't
exactly.
He? And he would have thought this was wank, essentially, wouldn't he?
Totally.
Yeah.
Was that famous quote about glam rock being rock and roll with lipstick on, that was a very Lennon thing to do. I love the fact that in Canada, again, like in Diamond Dogs, the voice and the music start speeding up, and it starts off quite slowly, quite stately.
Yeah.
And then as he gets more agitated and more desperate, and the lyrics become more and more surreal and ghastly. But then the music keeps up as well, and it's like dark, satanic band
speeding up.
And then you jump in the river holding hands. Boing! Then you get that big squealing sax. And then it comes back down for this lovely finale to Sweet Thing.
Isn't Sweet Thing,
it?
Which is beautiful.
It's so, so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And something about this is just that piano as well, the sax as well.
I don't know when he first got into Scott Walker's music, but I think you can start to hear the influence of Scott Walker here.
Is this where you really hear it?
I think you hear it on Sweet Thing.
Yeah.
I think you hear that kind of dark, bruised, inflected by soul, inflected by Brecht and Weill and those kind of things. But I guess at this point, he will have known about the increasingly unsuccessful Scott Walker Stringer solo albums. I'm guessing he would know about him by now. I don't know, but
I'm sure he would have picked up on between Scott 1 and 4.
He would have known about that, and presumably, he would have. And I think you're starting to hear that in Bowie's voice, and you'll hear it more and more.
Yeah. Because Scott Walker was really in the wilderness at this point, wasn't
completely
he? Until Night Flights, really.
Complete 75. The Walker brothers come back in 75 with No Regrets, and then he then languishes, I think, until 78 in Night Flights. But at this point, Scott Walker would literally be doing the Working Men's Clubs, right? We're in Salford. Would be doing the Working Men's
Club
around here. Yeah,
he was doing Working Men's Clubs.
He went through a period of doing that, Working Men's Club type thing.
Bee Gees did that at the same time.
Because he would have been going around singing his old hits, hating himself, and then doing them increasingly rarely. But in the wilderness, Scott Four is 70. There's that not very good album of then. There's the not very good album of Songs from the Movies. So he would be really in the wilderness at this point.
He had a TV show at that point, didn't he?
And
then he was doing really just.
See, if he was in the wilderness, that would have appealed to Bowie as well. I think if he hadn't, to this feeling of does this prophet without honour would have appealed to Bowie with his liking for the obscure and the unusual, be it the legendary Stardust Cowboy or Vince Taylor or whatever. I think that would have appealed to him as well, you know, because this was a guy that no one else was listening to, you know.
Something else that's interesting just about this finale of the reprise of Sweet Thing is when you come to Low and Heroes, that
Germanic influence, like his big love. But doesn't that remind you of Noi or someone? You know, when you get that crunching, grinding, doom, 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 and then it kind of locks into a real crap rock groove.
Well, that's right. I was thinking about this, thinking when you think you first hear the influence of Noi on Station to Station, I always think. Station to Station is the first album I always think of him. You can tell he's been listening to Noi.
Yeah.
But I guess he's probably... Would he have heard Noi by now? I guess so.
I mean, like, they had 69, 70, the first record. Again, listening to this the other week, it was one of the things that just leapt out at me. I thought, I've noticed that before.
Yeah.
It is pure Motorik krautrock.
Well, you hear it on the end. I think you hear it on Chance of the Ever Circling Skeletal Family.
Well, there as well, with that lock groove. Going round and round.
Yeah, that's right.
But here, it goes on for quite a while. And then you've got this sort of screeching feedback happening in the background.
Yeah,
it's very... I thought, you know, maybe there's a little tip of the hat. I don't know, had Metal Machine Music come out at that point? Or
yes. Oh, is Metal Machine Music 75?
I'm not sure if that's 74, 75. But, I mean, certainly the deliberate feedback, which is...
Absolutely. You know,
liberally plastered all over it.
With Lennon in the background tapping his watch.
come on, get a move on.
We want to go to the pub.
Come on, Bowie. Yeah. I think there's a real krautrock feel there.
Right, and I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. I certainly thought it had that kind of Berlin Marlene Dietrich feel to it.
Definitely.
Sort of smoky nightclub. You know, you can hear him singing in a deserted nightclub with Garson at the piano. I've heard that vibe, but certainly a Germanic vibe,
You must know that very funny story about John McEnroe.
No, I don't.
No?
Tell me it.
Okay. This is Rebel Rebel. Well, Bowie had some interview, early 2000s. One night I was in London in a hotel and I was trying to get some sleep. It was quite late, like about 11 or 12 at night. And I had some big deal thing on the next day, a TV show or something. So I was really trying to sleep. And I heard this riff being played really badly from upstairs. And I thought, who the hell's doing that this time of night? On an electric guitar, over and over and over, it was Rebel Rebel. So, in the end, I went upstairs to show the person how to play it. Imagine that, he's in this hotel.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Trying to sleep, and someone upstairs is trying to do Rebel Rebel. So, I bang on the door opens, and I say, listen, if you're going to play... And it was John McEnroe.
Wow, that's a great story.
I kid you not. And it was John McEnroe, who saw himself as some sort of rock guitar player at the time.
Yeah, he did,
so that could only happen in the movie. McEnroe trying to struggle his way through Rebel Rebel.
Yeah, that is fantastic.
But what a riff. What a riff. I mean, it's one of the classic old gold classic riffs.
Well, again, that you couldn't, you know, that gives the lie to the fact that Bowie's, you know, not a musician, you know.
Yeah.
He definitely. I mean, I know he doesn't play it on the record, but he wrote it, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
He came up with the bare bones of the riff.
Right.
And then the guitarist Alan Parker came in, literally took the riff off him and tweaked it and added that little tail. To it, What's weird is how that riff is just. I mean, Bowie wrote it. Was evidently so pleased with it that it's just pretty much constantly
throughout the song.
Like the last time by the Stones or something. Where the riff is just this nagging, insistent thing all the way through.
Yeah, Rebel Rebel sort of almost could be on a different record, couldn't it? In a way, because it's such a almost like a standalone song.
Yeah,
it's a great 70s pop single. It could have been on Ziggy. It could have been on Aladdin Sane almost, couldn't it?
Yeah.
It sort of leaps out from the record, doesn't it? Which is going to get dark again on Saturday. It's not a dark record, is it, Rebel Rebel? It's a sort of...
No,
it's in the great tradition of admiring songs, love letters to exciting, cool girls, isn't it, I guess?
Exactly. I mean, although the perspective of the singer seems to be a little bit older. It's not a peer, is it? It's not someone her age saying, you know, you're great, you're cool, I think you're really hot. It's like, your mother doesn't know if you're a boy or a girl.
That's right.
And again, we mentioned this earlier, but the death of glam. Glam was fading at this point, or glam had become a pastiche, or glam was just not the force it had been 2 years back. So what's that about, having this song?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure when he wrote it.
Right.
It may be that he wrote it. I mean, certainly this isn't one of the... Certainly this is nothing to do with 1984, is it? This is nothing to do with his Orwell musical.
Right.
And I don't know. It might be, maybe when he was writing this post-apocalyptic Ziggy kind of kids on the street musical.
It would fit in there much better than...
If he's got this idea to make this film about, to make this musical about roller skating kids in Hunger City, certainly one of those could be the you know, Rebel Rebel.
Yeah, and you can imagine a 1984 musical and a Brian suddenly, you know, bursting into song, singing Rebel Rebel at Winston and Julia, could you?
No, absolutely.
No,
this feels like it might have been written for that,
yeah.
for that other thing he's got on the go, or the Z, you know, or whatever this thing was going to be, that Halloween jacket, which sounds like it could have been terrible to me. Do you know what I mean? Like,
what if he'd gone with Halloween jacket and tried to make that a character?
Could, you see, the thing is, it's such a difficult thing to do, but I mean, but this obsession with doing musicals, which persisted all the way through his life, yeah. didn't it?
Look how happy he was to get Lazarus done.
I know, and it's some. If you think about the theatrical element of it, it can really change your view about Diamond Dogs. Mm. If you think about it too much, it can slightly put you off. So I was listening to 1984 the other day. I absolutely love 1984. I think it's a masterpiece that it, you know, how it appropriates what was going on in black music, but uses it to tell this dystopian story about, and the lyric, and but if you imagine, and it's easy to imagine, what it would have been like in the musical. Suddenly, you get a chill because I can see a lot of people running about the stage in that kind of fake and looking surprise that people do in musicals. And suddenly you think, oh my God, this could have been really awful. I'm glad it's just the record and I've not got that baggage.
Don't you think it would have been the intro, though? It would have been the beginning, wouldn't it?
Well, Diamond Dogs.
It's the theme.
But Rebel could sort of been the same, I guess.
Right.
There could have been a... In fact, this thing about roller skates, thinking about it, so was it going to be some kind of cross between 1984 and Starlight Express, this musical?
I'm thinking more about that famous scene in Christiane F, where the kids are running around Zoo Station, you know, and they're playing a weirdly sped-up version of Heroes.
But the thing is, to get it on the London stage, he would have had to made it pretty Starlight Express-y, wouldn't he? So I can sort of hear Rebel would have been... It could have fitted there because she's obviously part of this panoply of kids, you know, in Halloween Jack's gang, maybe. Or it would have fitted in that. But as you say, it's in a tradition. It's also in a tradition of records like the Shangri-Las, like where they're singing about a boy, where you're saying, hey, you're crazy, you're cool, you're a bit scuzzy, but I like you. Yeah. You know, it's in that tradition, which is a fairly strong rock and roll tradition.
Shangri-Las, which pretty much every song from that era was like, and then you're going to die in a motorbike crash.
But I love those. I love those.
Death pop.
But I just love the whole, it's Give Him a Great Big Kiss, where it was one of my favourite records ever, in a pop lyric where they say, in the outro, the spoken outro, is he a good dancer? And she goes, with absolute scorn, she goes, what do you mean, is he a good dancer? I love that moment. But it's kind of like that. It's an admiring song to somebody who's a bit odd, you know, and a bit kind of scuzzy, I think. I get the impression she's quite scuzzy.
I think so. Your hair's all right. Let's go out tonight. You like me, and I like it all.
Yes, yeah. It's a great line.
Exactly. To me, I mean, that's a little bit kind of like, I like everything. Yeah. Baby. We like dancing. We look divine.
And I think, does this come after the flop of Diamond Dogs? Or before, I think it comes. Does it come after? Is it the lead single from? I'm not sure whether it does.
I think we should look this up because it's important.
It is important because this is a big hit, isn't it?
I guess
this was everywhere. I seem to remember.
I think this was before Diamond Dogs. Right. I think so. I'll check in a minute.
Which will be interesting then, because maybe Rebel is a big hit, isn't it? I seem to remember that was on.
Oh, it's huge.
I seem to remember it was on the radio. It was on Radio 1 all the time when I was a kid.
And that definitely went higher than number 7 in Finland.
Sure, absolutely. But I wonder whether maybe that was such a big hit that when Diamond Dogs came on, people said, now we've had the good version of this, you know.
Let's have a look. Hello, pop pickers. Well, on the 15th of February 1974, Rebel was released. And that is quite a few months before the album was released. And it reached number 5 on the UK singles chart, so that is definitely a hit. It only reached about number 60-something on the US Billboard chart, not so much of a hit. Do you remember the video for this? He's there, he's got the eye patch on, and he's holding a Strat.
Wait,
like
I've seen this.
And there's a really shonky kind of camera. What would you call it? Like a sort of kaleidoscope
effect. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's just not, he's not even bothering.
No, he's not even bothering, is he? Yeah, he's really not bothering.
Flailing at the guitar. Yeah. He's got his eye patch on. He's sort of just singing. And I think that's totally intentional. It's meant to be that kind of what you talked about earlier. This is such a proto-punk album. The attitude's there. You know? Like the spiky 3-chord riff and all that, that's fine. But that attitude is there. The lyrics.
No, you're absolutely right. Both a valedictory kind of glam song, isn't it? Because by now glam is over, I guess, isn't it?
Glam is over. I mean, the shockiness. I think part of it could be a piss take, even. So, you know, you got your money.
Could be.
It's all got that sort of satirical edge to it. You know, the Daily Mail headline kind of feel to it.
Yeah,
you know,
but it's also got. It's also, you can hear the prefigurings of punk in it, can't you? Which I guess glam and punk are cut from the same kind of cloth in a way. In that when the punks come along, I'm sure they would have said, we like The Sweet and Slade a lot more than we like Pink Floyd and Genesis.
Right, right.
They would have seen those as maybe slightly lightweight versions of themselves and corporate versions of themselves. But I'm sure if you'd said to, you know, I'm sure if you were to say to those punk bands now, maybe not The Clash, but maybe, you know, I'm sure Johnny Rotten would probably have preferred the singles by Slade and T-Rex than he liked whatever else.
But then, like you said earlier, he was a Van de Graaff fan, wasn't he?
He was. Didn't
he sort of say he liked Curved Air or something like that?
All I remember Johnny Rotten was he did, in the 77, he did the equivalent of what would they call it now? Sort of the Radio 1's version of Desert Island Discs, and he picked the weirdest records. Hmm. He picked the Chieftains, he picked some dub reggae, and he picked Van de Graaff Generator and Peter Hamill. But it was a really odd period, the mid-70s. I was just starting to get into buying records. I was 13 or 14. And I remember thinking that there was there were a lot of bands who, just before punk, who didn't fit anywhere, probably have been listening to Diamond Dogs and Kraftwerk, and they didn't. There were bands like Deaf School from Liverpool, Split Enz from Australia, all of which were slightly theatrical.
Was Split Enz going at that point? Mid-70s?
Yeah, they were. Right, Split Enz, because the first Split Enz was produced by Manzanera from Roxy. So there was all these things going on.
Right.
Glam, and I think a certain dissatisfaction with because in some ways Split Enz are a prog rock band, not with prog as in records being complicated and flamboyant, but with them being kind of ponderous,
bloated,
exactly,
pompous,
and more the pomposity of Emerson, Lake and Palmer going on stage on tour in those three Pantechnicons with a 60-piece orchestra. Bowie is a lot of the time in Bowie's music you hear not prog as in terribly complicated structures, but as in ambition.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As in a sonic
the
ambition.
The scope of what he's
scope
doing.
Scope of what you can do. You know what I mean? So that by the time we get to station to station, he'll say, I'm going to start this record with a track that lasts 10 minutes and that I don't even sing for the first four minutes or whatever. That kind of ambition, I think, that prog rock had given people. It's a bit like when punk happened. I remember just after punk happened, Kate Bush happened. And there's nothing punk about Kate Bush at all. Mm. But I remember thinking, Wuthering Heights probably got to number one in a way because of punk, because that sense of everything's up for grabs now. Do you know what I mean? That you've had a kind of hegemony of a certain kind of music going along, but then someone comes along and says...
Breaks
all that down. And suddenly a helium-voiced teenage girl can have a massive hit.
Or Mull of Kintyre can stay.
Exactly. Exactly. That idea that we're in... All the rules of the rule book's kind of been torn up.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean that I think you get that people like Bowie did that, you know. But returning to Rebel, it's a funny song, isn't it? It's not as dark as anything else on the record. It feels like a standalone single composed as that to me. But I don't know if it was. Maybe it was from this musical.
I think it's also got that very, very Bowie trait of one eye to the future.
Yeah.
Now, you know that the end of it, from the midpoint of Rebel, it goes into this, you got your cue line and handful of ludes, you want to be there, which kind of, to me, predates Young Americans, where you have that long kind of gospel-style fade out, where he's just incantatory
over
the
end.
And this, so what you want to know, calamities, childhood, you know, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said earlier, he's been listening to soul. He's been listening to soul, which had its roots in a sort of, you know, kind of gospel.
Well, if you listen to those records that Temptations made in the early 70s, Temptations, Isaac Hayes, all those long soul records.
Isaac Hayes, God, people
are not afraid to have very long fades where people are, for want of a better word, kind of testifying.
Yeah.
Or preaching, that Bowie certainly picked up, I think, on this record. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That feeling of the band will keep on with this mood and I'll just kind of freeform. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think psychedelic soul is what, this is a much darker thing than psychedelic soul, but he's certainly been, he's always been, you know, a bit like Elton John's supposed to be the same, except you never hear in Elton John's music. But Elton John apparently knows about everything that's going on. People have often told me about this, Elton John, that if you talk to Elton John, he can talk to you about trap music or the current indie favourites. But you never hear it in his music, which is always the same. But with Bowie, you get the feeling he was always, what's the next thing, as you're saying? But Bowie would introduce it into his music quick. He would get it into his music very quickly.
And then move on.
And again, Rebel, maybe by now he's been to some clubs in America where, I guess by 74, people like Television and the Heartbreakers will be playing in clubs in New York. So maybe he's heard them.
I think definitely Blondie were playing at this point.
Yeah.
Or what was their previous incarnation? Before they were Blondie, there was something, weren't there, that was a bit more proggy.
She was in a band called Wind in the Willows. Which
that was it.
Yeah.
You just reminded me, the Rodney Bingenheimer playing in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
Famous
disco,
I think it was called the English Disco.
Rodney's English Disco.
This was his half hour, every half hour, he was playing Rebel Rebel.
Did he?
Because all those girls that went on to become the Runaways or Susie Quattro, Joan Jett, all that lot, this was their song.
That is exactly who I have in mind. When I heard Rebel Rebel then and I hear it now, that's exactly who I have in mind. That kind of street smart, tough, but cute, but not cute in any kind of drippy, way.
Cute, badass,
The Runaways, Susie Quattro.
Right. This was their theme tune.
Oh, you can totally get that.
This was their theme tune. And this is where Iggy used to be hanging out. Danny Sugarman and Iggy were hanging out there. Iggy was at really a low point at that point. But they said they would drive over to the English Disco. Rodney would be there, the king of, what was it, the mayor of Sunset Strip, whatever he called himself. And Rebel Rebel was, because, you know, in America, they can be a bit more slow to catch on. And these trends are kind of filtered across the Atlantic and got to the West Coast.
And obviously Bowie, of course, with his being, I guess, a progressive person who would write a song like this for a girl. You know, you could certainly see that. It's not the kind of sleazy song, really, is it? It's a celebratory song.
Yeah, it's totally celebratory.
He's not trying to pick her up. He's celebrating her, really. And I can totally see that a tranche of young women will pick this up as a kind of anthem, you know. So, yeah, it's great. I mean, even though he says, like, Hot Tramp, I Love You So, and it still isn't a sleazy. He manages to sidestep sleazy. Maybe that's because he's Bowie. Maybe if...
If it was Gary Glitter singing
Or even if a lot of other people from the rock, you know.
Most people at that time, if Jagger was someone who was singing it, it would have been...
There were some creepy records about it at the time. I don't know if it classifies as a glam record or not, but if you want to have a case study in creepiness, My Cuckoo by Alvin Stardust. Mm-hmm. Everything about that record, from the performance to the black glove to the lyric, is about as creepy a record as you can get. But this isn't. This is massively celebratory. It's up-tempo, it's...
They're in two different universes, Alvin Stardust and David Bowie. Well, Alvin Stardust was pure schlock and, you know...
See anybody doing the Alvin Stardust albums podcast.
Well, actually, Stuart, now you mentioned it, I was going to ask if you would come onto my next podcast, Alvin to Alvin.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But the Alvin Stardust
albums podcast. Okay, well, I'm going to set it up.
Okay, you set it up now. Yeah. It doesn't have that undertow of salacious creepiness. I mean, just now you put me in mind of, what was it, that ABBA song, Does Your Mother Know?
Oh, yes.
Which I heard recently the other day on my iPod.
That's weird.
And that really is...
That is weird.
And I mean, there is this tradition, that generation of rock stars.
Yeah. Oh, cool, absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely. But it's strange for ABBA doing it.
I know. But Bjorn sings it as well.
It's a very strange... Yeah,
And you don't want to think about Bjorn like that.
I love ABBA, but that is a... So we draw a veil over that part of the work.
I just don't... Bjorn has such a kindly face, and you don't want to imagine him.
But you're right, it was kind of acceptably... It was almost thought of as kind of a bit, it was kind of naughty but nice, it isn't anything like that.
But do you think that's, in a microcosm, how things like Savile and everything kind of happened?
Absolutely.
Because that was our approach.
That world. I imagine,
obviously we didn't know what he was doing.
Absolutely. It was not seen as... Maybe it's because rock music is still young.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the important thing to think about. Rock music is still young and it's still being made by young people. Nowadays, there are still some young people making rock, but the rock, we're doing this now. Rock has become an older and reflective exercise. Its practitioners are older. So now we think, wait a minute, it's no longer the preserve of 20-odd-year-olds.
Right.
And being made for teenagers. But it was then. So it probably wasn't seen as offensive or salacious to be celebrating the world of the teenager.
Right.
Because these people have been teenagers themselves not long before.
Exactly. I mean, Chuck Berry talks about it a lot. Rolling Stones, like you mentioned before.
Well, they were younger then. I mean, the 1975, whose music I love, but the singer in the 1975, well, love's putting it a bit strong, I quite like. he said recently, the older generation don't understand young people like me. And I thought, hang on, you're 29. 29 at this period would have been decrepit.
That's it.
Would have been decrepit.
George Harrison was doing All Things Must Pass at that point.
Oh, my God. I mean, McCartney's changed the world and broke the Beatles up before then. So 29 is not young, not then. And that's why maybe it wasn't so unacceptable for Iggy to be down Rodney's English Disco hanging out with 17-year-old girls. Because Iggy was probably only, in his late 20s or something like that?
He would have been mid to late 20s at that
point.
But they would cram a lifetime into that. I mean, again, you mentioned the Beatles now, and I was talking about Abbey Road some the other day, and then it always stops you in your tracks when you realise that how old they were.
Oh my God, yeah.
George was 26.
That's unthinkable, isn't it? Now? I know. Unthinkable. I mean, how old's Bowie at this point? Late 20s?
Doing this, 74. Yeah. Oh, he was
48, 47. Is he born?
47.
So he's in his late 20s, mid to late 20s.
I know. Yeah, I know.
So, you know, he's way younger than the 1975 are. So you can sort of understand. So when we say, is it a bit creepy that he's from an old position of an older guy? He's an older guy of 26 singing about what? A late teenage girl.
Which was basically geriatric in that context, wasn't it?
But it's also, as well as being celebratory, it has the feel of in the best sense of the word, an old fashioned record. It's straight out of 60s pop and you know, it has charm. It's a charming record, Rebel Rebel, for all that it has the trappings of being slightly punkish and gum chewing, and there is this element of it's a celebration of a young woman. Not massively a celebration of her sexuality, more of her style.
It's
a style, yeah.
And I think he totally got away with doing this song on tour right up till his final tour. He was doing this on his reality tour, and it worked. I mean, I think he recut it, well, he remixed it for the States. So it was cut in the UK as part of the album, but RCA in America felt it just needed something extra. So he flew over to the States, and which is where he met Carlos Alomar, actually, was on that session. And he kind of remixed it. So there's tons of phasing going on. There's echo. I think they chop off this long fade out. And that's the hit single version.
That's the hit single version.
That's the version. And it becomes this kind of bouncy, wonderful track. But he also flips it around a little bit. So you start off with a hot tramp. I love you so.
Yeah.
Doom, doom, bam, 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 bam. And he was doing that version. Right until the end.
Which he could without any. Whereas, you know, to return to the Rolling Stones, if you see the Rolling Stones now, not so much now because they've reined it in a bit, but I saw if you saw the Rolling Stones 10 years ago, maybe playing some of their older records, it sat very badly. Watching these ancient old men in cropped t-shirts.
They still do, doing Under My Thumb.
It sits badly, whereas Bowie could still do Rebel, because there's nothing in Rebel Rebel. There's nothing nasty about Rebel Rebel. It does seem to me, to be a very exuberant, punkish kind of street corner celebration of a young woman's style.
Exactly.
And her identity. As much as I love My Sharona, it isn't My Sharona, which is a record that reeks of goat, doesn't it? You know what I mean? that is the most salacious record I've ever made, but I still love it.
I hadn't analysed the lyrics of My Sharona. I love the riff so much.
It's a great record, but don't pay strong attention to the lyrics. I think we're supposed to think that the protagonist of it, again, is not hugely older, but it certainly is the most drooling, lascivious record about a young woman you can
ever
hear.
Listen to that again now.
Yeah, it's a great record.
From that era, I mean, it is. I mean, I love that, you know, heavy stop-start riff.
Yeah.
But from that era, you've also got stuff like Turning Japanese, which you couldn't really do now without sort of.
But there was a tradition. I think it may have been that the male protagonist of the songs, and I'm not just saying this to let them off the hook, because they were still relatively young. It doesn't have the creepiness that a 40-year-old guy singing about a 16-year-old girl would have. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, Stuart, I think we're going to leave it there for part one.
Wow, we've only got to side one, right? We'll flip it over in a few weeks.
So, from BBC in Manchester.
Salford. The Salfordians won't have it. Technically, we're in Salford. You only have to walk 5 minutes over there to be in Manchester, but we're technically in Salford.
I arrived in Manchester, and now I'm in Salford.
You are.
So to Stuart,
City to city.
So, to Stuart in Salford, opportunity knocks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your time today. It's been fantastic.
Thank you.
We'll be back to talk about part two soon.
Great.
Fantastic. And that was me and Stuart McConey. And the next part of our conversation about Diamond Dogs is yet to take place. I hope it will do soon over the magic of Skype or Zoom or one of those things. And as soon as we've done it, I will let you know and I will put it online. Till then, take care, all the best, and thank you for listening.